Myth, episode 581 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and I promise no casting dog this time.
This is Gary from Jacksonville, and I'm not quite sure what time we're in right now.
Yeah, and well, I don't know what time we're in, but I sure as hell hope it's not winter, because I see what winter looks like, and I don't want any part of it. And yeah, we are going to be talking finally, for those of you who have been waiting very patiently, we're going to be talking about the episodic content for this week. There were only 9 episodes to talk about. And to see, if we didn't string out Daredevil, we'd have even less. But yeah, we have only 9 episodes, so we don't have a top and bottom 3, because if we did that, we wouldn't have anything left. We have a top and bottom 2 this time around. But we're going to basically get through this, and it's probably not going to take us very long. But before we do any of that, just a couple of reminders. As usual, we will be... getting into these episodes and scoring them. We've all scored them, both ourselves here on the show and our extended Critical Myth family, on a scale from 0 to 10, 7 being the typical average, 8 being above average, and then 9 being more your exceptional, and so forth, up to the usually very personal 10, where it has just knocked it out of the park for some personal reason. But before we go into the actual details, Edmund, I've put off the disclaimer long enough, haven't I?
Absolutely. I just need to warn everybody that we will discuss whatever we feel like, plot points, things that have happened in the episode, things that finished up the episode and really amazed us. So yes, you will be spoiled. But as John said, 9 episodes. You know, everybody should have been caught up long ago.
Yes, we have very, very, very large expectations about your viewing. So we expect you to be able to follow along here without any delay. We are going to first talk about the shows that were at the bottom of the list. And, you know, I say the bottom of the list, and we've had these kinds of weeks where the bottom of the list is like, 7, maybe a little bit above. This week, there were only 9 episodes, but they were 9 good episodes. Yes. All of them were good. The lowest ones here, the ones at the bottom, came in at 7.75. That's practically above average. Everything was like knocking it out of the park. We haven't had a week like this in a while. But at any rate, the quote-unquote bottom, which could have been the top episodes in some other week. First one here we have is Lost Girls, Season 5, Episode 7, Here Comes the Night. No double entendre there, of course. The aftermath of a storm is dealt with by Bo and her friends. Like I said, this came in at a 7.75. And Edmund, any particular thoughts on this one?
Well, with this, certainly with the introduction of the reveal, I guess, of the Ancients last episode, and this is the first episode of seeing the ramifications of that, and they're doing a little bit of fancier storytelling than they usually do. This whole thing of sort of throwing us into into this storm, sort of right from the beginning, and having the audience play a little bit of catch up, and I think that disorientation was was deliberate, since as the nature of this monster that's been released started to make its presence felt, and Bo, or was it Bo, or weren't quite sure what was going on with all the various liaisons, and how much was hallucinations, I thought it did a pretty effective job of throwing the audience and most of the cast off balance.
Yeah, speaking of knocking the cast off balance, if there's anyone out there that doubts the existence of the friend zone, Tamsin would like a word.
Yes.
Wow, that was just brutal, the end of this episode. And I've got to say, I feel a little bit for Tamsin, and I actually feel like Bo is in the wrong here. It is a bit of a special circumstance. We're talking about a succubus, and, you know, the rules are a little bit different in this particular case, but Bo had to know what she was kind of doing here, at least on some level. And Tamsin has always been a little bit emotionally stunted since her introduction. So yeah, I feel kind of like this could easily become Tamsin being kind of shoving back. And she's always been kind of ambiguous where she lands. This first half of the season, she's been an ally. I could easily see her going bad. in the second half of the season.
Yeah, definitely. But also, I'm not completely convinced that there isn't some sort of outside influence acting on Bo. That's going to be part of the reveal down the road. Certainly that would be quite ironic if that's part of what drives Tamsin into being more of a villain, because I definitely see that possibility as well.
Yeah, when you watch it and it plays out, it's really and considering that Lost Girl has been a little bit of a slow sell for us this season so far, the fact that I can use the words heartbreaking, it's actually really cringeworthy heartbreaking. It's just, you feel for Tamsin so much, and it's just, oh, you're going there. Oh, that's not, oh, don't do that to yourself. Oh, Bo, what are you doing? You're making it worse. So, yeah, it was pretty brutal. Edmund, if you don't mind taking the other one that was here at the bottom of the list.
Certainly. That was Salem, Season 2, Episode 9, Wages of Sin. Mary and Wainwright grow closer. At the same time, the starry messenger comet approaches Earth. Anne continues to glean knowledge from her dead father's writings, and a long brewing feud reaches a tipping point.
Yes, and again, 7.75. And I've said this before, in this case, I was the one that was a little bit lower. And for me, I still maintain, and they're really going to have to sell me on this, I feel like that this season is coming towards a conclusion, and it feels like this should be a 10-episode season,
mm-hmm.
but it's 13. And I'm really feeling like, guys, you're bringing this to – you're wrapping a lot up here. Show me that there's more to do, please, because, Mary's doing her turnabout here where she's, allying herself with John Alden and all of that's happening. And it's like, if we're going to drag this out, this could be like that situation that we were talking about a couple episodes ago with Defiance, where, yep, the plot's going and then we got to stop for a little while. And I feel like the season has had such good momentum. Don't blow it.
Yeah, I'm a little more optimistic, and certainly it's a supernatural show, so nobody's fate is set in stone or in mud or goop or whatever it is. So the fact that the good doctor appears to be gone is something where I'm allowing them plenty of latitude for over these next few episodes, where that is going to come back and have different ramifications, shall we say.
It's possible. I'll be happy if they can surprise me with where they go with this. So, we shall see. All right, so let's see where the next one is here. Oh, well, why don't we then go ahead from the bottom of the list, go up to the top two. And here are a couple episodes that were definitely deserving of being up at the top. And coming in at our number two position, with an average of 8.8, Daredevil, Season 1, Episode 9, Speak of the Devil. Fisk gains the upper hand, making the goal to vanquish him even more difficult. Meanwhile, Daredevil must face his own demons, in the form of a ninja. Mm-hmm. Anyway, yes, this one, like I said, came in at an 8.8. And, Henry and Nadim loved this one tremendously. I know that Henry had a lot to say about the kind of moral discussion or exploration in this episode, and that final act was really quite amazing as far as I was concerned, especially how it wrapped up. Talking about cliffhangers on Daredevil, that was one for you. But Gary, you gave this one an 8, which was it's hardly bad. It's above average, but it was the lowest score, and I'm curious if this is continuing to be your kind of issues with the portrayal of Kingpin.
Yes, John, it is. you hit the nail on the head. That's exactly what it is. I didn't feel that he was in such a desperate position that he would dirty his hands yet like this. It seemed that that Daredevil has not aggravated him or pushed him out of his comfort zone enough to warrant Kingpin himself physically getting involved. And not that he couldn't obviously handle himself pretty well, but It seemed beneath him. I would think he would have to reach that enraged point. And I really don't see where he's at now. I mean, I know he's been poked and prodded, like when the Asian woman sort of told him to get his house in order and things of that nature. But it didn't seem like he had reached that aggravation point where he's out of control and where he would reach this point. On the other hand, the actor is playing this guy as sort of much more on the edge than I perceive the character to be. So that could just be my personal personal view of the character coloring, how I'm interpreting this. But that was part of it. I didn't like the idea of the ending that his identity was found out this early in the series for Foggy. I would have liked to seen it stretched out a little bit more. I think this is it's too early. I think he still needs to be more of the loner than for a while yet. I was a little disappointed that they sort of blew that early.
Mm. Edmund, how about you? Your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I with this one, I mean, I pretend there were two things that sort of stood out. I mean, one was yes, the latest amazing fight with the ninja, but before that, sort of the psychological end of things, that whole meeting in the art gallery with Matt and Vanessa and then Fisk, how that was then playing into the uncertainties about, okay, this guy isn't a monster. There is somebody he loves and who loves him. And is it my role then to take him out? And certainly playing into that, the whole Catholic background and returning to the priest. I thought that was some very, very, very strong aspects. And also certainly, is one of those things that the Daredevil series, I think, in general, in the comics, delves into far more than your typical comics do, and it was nice to see them bringing that element in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that. Like I said, the final act of the episode worked for me. Apparently, a little bit better than for Gary, but like I said, I know that has been a little bit of a low point, or not necessarily a low point, but one of the things that is not quite working for you as well in terms of the depiction of the Kingpin. I can understand it. It's definitely a very style. It's a specific choice on the part of the writers and producers to depict him the way that they are.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's not something that everybody is necessarily going to go for. But I think we can safely say that despite all of the controversies lately on this show, the writers and producers decided to deliver, to say the least, with our number one show for the week, and that is Game of Thrones, Season 5, Episode 8, Hard Home. John pleads his case to form a new alliance north of the Wall that is immediately put to the test. Meanwhile, oh boy.
Yeah.
Arya makes progress in her training, Sansa learns surprising news about her family, and Daenerys and Tyrion find they have something in common. Yes, or as I can just summarize it as it's been throughout the interwebs this week, come at me, Crow. oh boy, let's go into some of the other things first. Before we suddenly have our post-traumatic stress of that battle. So the first thing that comes to mind is that Cersei continues to have some, well, not so pleasant experiences as she has to kind of deal with the fallout of not confessing to her crimes against the Seven. Gary, any thoughts on that one in particular?
Yeah, that's sort of what dragged this episode down for me, was this whole the whole Cersei plot.
Drag down in the sense of you gave it a 9 versus. Yeah. But anyway, let's continue. Yes.
Yeah, that's what brought me to my abysmal score for this episode. Yeah. No, I didn't feel it was handled properly. It doesn't seem true to the character for me. I think she's always been a much more plotting type of person. So for her to just have this sort of unrestrained anger, and not that she's not entitled to it, but she'd always struck me as slightly smarter or slightly more scheming than this. And it doesn't seem like she's there. These constant threats against the female warden or guard, I guess it would be. I would think, she's already realized that that's not going to do anything. And I thought she'd play it a little bit smarter, but it doesn't seem like she is. And that was disappointing to me. She's becoming almost more of a caricature than a character.
Edmund, how about you? What are your thoughts on this plot line?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, I mean, I've always seen Circe as, I'm a little too full of pride and hubris, and that her maneuverings, certainly of all of the Lannisters were the most transparent. So for me, certainly, but both in the books and then in the way they're depicting it, I mean, it did just seem like, this was some of her inadequacies in playing the game coming back to finally. Those chickens coming home to roost there, but certainly, I mean, that whole sequence of refusing the water and then and realizing like no, she has to get water somehow, and then just to have that scene of her forced to lick it off the floor just certainly really brought exactly how far she's fallen into sharp relief.
Yeah, I think I weigh more towards your end on this, Edmund. This felt like them condensing a lot of that kind of, pride goeth before a fall type of consequence into those three scenes. What I am curious of is that there was that one very pointed scene with Qyburn in the and those references to other plans.
Yes.
Yeah, I guess they're going forward with some of those plot points from the books. Mm-hmm. Moving on then to a scene that I think made a lot of us very happy, and that was Sansa confronting Theon.
Yes.
Oh, I like it when she has backbone. And talk about really kind of hitting somebody where it hurts. She was really going after Theon in this scene. And what I like about this is that this is very much... Okay, if Sansa was being kind of prodded by her experience on her wedding night and thereafter, if that was the only reason that she was starting to fight back finally, it would have been kind of... as I've said many times before, disappointing. However, that was, I believe, a start to her turnaround, but it's the knowledge that her brothers are still alive that I think is going to be the biggest difference. Because it's no longer just about her being the last of the Starks and having to find a way to deal with that, but now she is, in fact, the lady and the eldest of her house.
Right.
That's a big difference, I think. And I think that will be a more meaningful turn for her character if they continue along this path. So I feel like they kind of gave me something to work with here. Edmund, I mean, anything to add to Sansa and Theon?
Yeah, no. Well, they had been sort of hinting at Theon making this reveal. I felt a couple of times. I mean, during the dinner, I remember there was this moment when he sort of had to have this look pass across Theon or Reek's face, and I wondered if he was going to toss that out then. And but I think certainly it works much better him doing it just to Sansa. And so yeah, it's just another arrow in her quiver, basically. As you say, her reasons to stand up and we presume follow through on what Littlefinger was saying and getting Winterfell back eventually.
Gary, any additional thoughts on this one?
I still don't feel she's playing the game. I think she just reached that frustration point. I think now that, as Edmund said, that she is more invested, or I guess as you were saying, she's got more invested in the future at this point with her family still surviving. Now I think we might start to see the game played a little bit because she definitely has purpose besides herself to do it.
Yeah, I see this. I agree with that. I guess that what I was reacting to was the fact that it would be one thing if she was just deciding she's got to play the game but didn't show that she had some fire in there. But her lashing out at Theon and her kind of needling Ramsay about his lineage was showing at least the first few sparks of that fire. And finally, we see that she has a reason. And it is, in fact, her family, which, is a nice tie back when one thinks about it to the fact that Sansa, to a certain degree, took her family for extreme granted in the first season. And it's kind of a nice turn for her to maybe, they follow through as we believe they are, if it's her family and her surviving brothers that are the reason why she decides to start playing kind of like the way that her mother would have. So it's a good character turn, I think, for her that has nothing to do with Ramsay. Just saying.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
That's to me a great thing. But the better sister of Starks in my mind.
Yes.
Oh, Arya, how we love thee. I really like the storyline. How about you, Gary?
It's coming along very well. She feels that, unlike us, how Sansa knows that there are surviving Starks, she doesn't believe there's any surviving. So she's trying to find her own place, and she's going, of course, with the her savior, so to speak, the guy from the House of Black and White, and she's doing her best to excel there. She, as you think about back even her early character when she was trying to learn how to sword fight, she was very sort of dedicated and focused, and that sort of focus in her life has continued to her lessons here that she's doing so well. I was wondering, however, as they were giving the story and they mentioned that she needed to go right instead of left, I had the sense that she has never actually stepped foot out of that place yet, and that going to the right was the first time she ever actually was that character out in the real world, where the rest was just her like imagination of the character.
Interesting interpretation. How about you, Edmund? What do you think of that?
I hadn't considered that part. I was thinking that it was just her sort of dry runs and getting herself set in the city before they finally gave her an assignment. Was my interpretation of the right and left. But I kind of like Gary's as well, especially given some of the sort of mystical overtones of the House of Black and White. That storyline is just chugging along nicely. Certainly intrigued. I mean, now that we are really butting up against that point where they're going to have caught up to the books, to see exactly how far they take her in these last two episodes.
Yeah, I'm quite intrigued. I really do enjoy this exploration of her her plot line. It's been condensed, but it's still hitting all the right notes. Now, talking about material, like you said, a nice segue, by the way, of material that is beyond what is in the books, we have what is one of the highlights. And if it wasn't for the second half of the episode, this may have been the plot line that everybody was raving about. And it's the discussions between Tyrion and Daenerys, especially that second one over wine. Oh, wow. The two of them just verbally sparring. I could watch an entire episode of that. Just give Peter Dinklage a lot to work with and let Emilia Clarke kind of play off of him.
Mm-hmm. No, and this is a case of this meeting that everybody had been waiting for, and obviously that was put a huge amount of pressure on the writers, and I think they handled it really, really well. I mean, that was just as intelligent and witty and obviously perceptive in terms of the way that both of them were sort of feeling each other out, and obviously in Tyrion's case, having to now sort of put up or shut up in terms of I really can be a wonderful advisor to you, and he certainly showed it. I mean, some of them then is, as you said, John, in that second discussion, his jabs at her about what is it like ruling without the rich, and then her whole metaphor of I don't want to be the latest one pushing the wheel. I want to break the whole wheel. Certainly an interesting perspective to bring, and especially this whole idea of maybe called Game of Thrones, but she may have decided that let's just stop playing this game, period.
it is her family that was basically not playing the game. Yes. for a whole dynasty. They kind of ruled the roost, and that was all there was to it. I was going to say, the thing that I really liked about that discussion was that there are a lot of people, us included, who sit back and wonder when you're reading the books and everything, and you go, why is George R. R. Martin keeping her in Meereen all this time? Yes. And Tyrion, in one line, puts it in perfect perspective, and you go, oh, was that what he was getting at? Where it was, you're learning what it means to try to rule with just the people behind you.
Yeah.
And they have no power, and look where you're at. You can't do it with just the will of the people. You need the people who have power to also back you. And in Westeros, they're seeing what happens when it's just the people in power trying to rule. It doesn't work because you just keep killing each other off. Yeah. You need a balance of both. And that's where Tyrion is like, he has that perspective to give to Daenerys that could very well change her entire outlook of her success, because it's like, the way you were going to do it, you were going to fail dramatically to go to Westeros and try to do that. but I can give you a better solution. And I kind of liked that. That's a good start to maybe transforming that whole subplot. But Gary, you were going to add some stuff to this too?
Oh, no, I was just going to say, you call it verbal sparring, but even before they started going back and forth, I loved how Tyrion kept sort of interjecting in a non-direct way why he should be kept and what the value of his counsel is. Like, well, I think, you know, when I was king, hand of the king, he would like constantly back up his own case before he even made
yes.
I thought it was an interesting verbal technique to basically pat himself on the back as he was telling her what he thinks.
And then that wonderful little move of the, well, I'm still trying to figure out if you're worthy of my service.
Yes.
It's like, well, if you only have one hand to play, you might as well just throw it on the table and see how it goes. Yeah, I really. And meanwhile, we have Ser Jorah, a friend zone. Just at this point, you know, I thought he was a little pathetic before. What is he thinking? Like, honestly, what does he think he's accomplishing by going to the fighting pits at this point? Other than I'm going to die in front of you and see if you care. I mean, what does he think is gonna happen? No, please don't die. You're lucky she let you walk out. It's come on. Anyway, I guess we'll see where that plays out, but I'm sure that there will be some grand sacrifice because he's already dead already for all intent purposes with the grayscale from his point of view. I'm going up to the wall in this next one, but I'm not going as far north as you think. I did want to talk about that conversation between Sam, Gilly, and Ollie because I feel like that was the writers putting it on the nose about as much as you could. But in that wonderful tragic way that Sam, that he didn't take that the way you thought. Oh, this is not going to end well. Where he sits there and basically says, good men make hard choices that no one else is going to understand, but it's for the greater good. And Ollie's like, yeah, they do. And you just think, that's not going to end well. Yeah, I'm guessing the two of you also read into that exactly what I did.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, Ollie's probably going to have some very ill-advised plans. Let's put it that way. And that's all going to wait, of course, for John to get back from Hard Home, and we're lucky he's going to be able to. I kind of put this two ways in my review. The first one was that there's a point in the episode, several, actually, where you think to yourself, surely, this is as bad as it's going to get. And then it just gets really just dramatically worse.
Yes.
it just keeps happening again and again. And you just go, really? This isn't the worst. Okay.
Nope.
And pretty much right to the last minute, it just keeps getting worse. And then I was just thinking that, you know, you've had all these great conversations and scenes throughout the rest of the episode. You had all that great stuff with Tyrion and Daenerys. You had the Sansa scene. You had the stuff at the wall with Sam and Ollie. And you go, wow, this is really just a great episode of scene after scene after scene. And then you had that really good scene between Jon and the Free Folk, and he's convincing some of them to go with him. And you're like, okay, I see. Yeah. And okay, so that's about where that's going to end. And then the dogs start to whine.
Yes.
And you just get that feeling in the pit of your stomach. And you go, oh, no. Winter is coming. No, winter's here. And there's really not a whole lot to say about it other than holy cow.
I think it was the moment when we saw the Westeros version of the Legend of the Lemmings spring to life. It was like, okay, yes, this is this is not good, and certainly, I mean, this is a case where I mean, it actually is reaching the point where it has been a while since I finished the book, so I did go back and research it, but the whole thing that this was a battle that, if I remember right, was, you know, what was largely told through letters, you know, it was happening basically off camera. But obviously, the fact that now you're doing it on TV in a visual medium, you know, and they had this beautiful opportunity to, as we've been talking about, through the years of, you know, now this, you know, this unseen looming threat from north of the wall, and you know, and then they're given this opportunity to just completely lay it out of, you know, just how bad the enemy they're facing is, and of course that amazing moment of all those people you just lost are now just swelling the ranks of your enemy, was just exactly as chilling as they hoped it would be.
Oh, yeah. And you're right. It was referenced in the books and the funny thing is, yes, it's in letters, but literally the line that I believe it is, it's like one line in a letter basically saying, yeah, things kind of went bad at Hardhome. That's all.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, there's some people died. Yeah, this is what you meant? Holy, okay. But yes, that's exactly what I got from it was that, yeah, talk about a reversal of fortune. You know, John's just happy to get 5,000 people to come back with him. And he's like, don't worry. And, you know, like Thormald is like, oh, yeah, don't worry. The rest of them will be convinced. Not quite. Now there's thousands upon thousands of the enemy. And it's like, oh, not only did we not convince them to come with us, but now they are like the undead. Great. You know, this is a bad day. But I loved the fact that if you buy into the theory that John is going to become at least very powerful, let us say, perhaps a king later, mm-hmm. and perhaps one of the, if not the, kind of representation of fire and to some extent later down the road, whether it be as Daenerys's love interest or what have you, or doesn't matter, to have the Night King on the dock facing Jon down the way that it was. It's like, from a literary perspective, there's no greater sense that Jon is going to be really, really important than that.
Yes.
I mean, it's like driving, like, yes, this will be revisited and it will not be pretty.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, that scene almost gave me a little bit of hope because they seemed like such mindless creatures before then. But as he did that, even as scary as that was to have all the people sort of rise up, the way the Ice King or
Night King
was almost boasting and his sense of, you know, come on, bring it on, or look what I got kind of thing sort of makes me think that, okay, well, you know, he's not this impenetrable, just driving sort of force of nature thing. There is some mentality behind that, and that might be at least something of a chance. He could, you know.
Oh, so it was definitely some posturing because he saw Jon kill one of the White Walkers.
Yeah.
Yes.
So he was doing that in response, basically to say, okay, you found a vulnerability, but how is you and your little sword going to handle all this? But the fact that he had to make that gesture, like you said, Gary, speaks volumes. If he didn't see it as a threat, he wouldn't have bothered.
Yeah.
So it isn't, that's where I say it's like, ooh, you are basically seeing the line being drawn here. Even if you just take John as the kind of Lord Commander at the wall, and therefore the person at the front lines that's going to have to revisit this sometime later, then yeah, that battle line is drawn. They, you know, you just get the sense this is the first time they meet, but they are going to meet again, and it's going to be nasty. And I'm looking forward to it because this was pretty damn awesome. And I know there are people who are sitting back and saying, well, they just did in one 20-minute sequence what the Walking Dead has been unable to do for 5 seasons. But I feel like the Walking Dead is depicting their zombies as this, like, the slow march of nature against, you know, civilization. It is the tide on the shore just constantly eroding the sand dune, you know, versus this, which is, here's your avalanche. This is your tsunami of the undead. It's not some slow, inexorable, deadly force. It is directed at you. A little bit different force of nature, I guess you could say. But any other thoughts on this, Edmund?
I did just want to mention I did have a odd bit of viewing synchronicity with this one when Carsey, the female wildling leader, was introduced. I was having a case of deja vu because she's played by Danish actress Birgit Sørensen, whose big claim to fame before now is the series Borgen, which I just happened to be in the middle of watching. So it was like, wait a minute, I know you. when she came on, and
with I hope she fares better in that show than on this one.
Yeah, well, on that show, she's the rising star of one of the TV networks. Because Borgen is it was funny, after I'd watched a couple of episodes, I deliberately just googled Danish West Wing and discovered that yes, a lot of people had a similar reaction to me.
Okay.
Yeah, and certainly it's a show that you know, if you've had experience living in or know about parliamentary democracies, it's quite a bit bit easier to follow because it's all the machinations of the new prime minister who unexpectedly comes to power. So
gotcha.
But certainly I was then also very happy to see her reanimated at the end. So she apparently will still be around. So.
Well, kinda.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, come on. We all knew how that was going to end when she's like, okay, kids, get in the boat.
Oh, exactly. Oh, you're dead.
Oh, I like you. Well, that was 5 minutes well spent. Yeah. So this one obviously was an episode that just about everyone raved about. And Flacco Jones gave this one a 10 over at the VOG Network and said, a really amazing episode. I was already enjoying it when it was just people talking, especially whenever Tyrion and Dany were the focus. But once that huge scale battle broke out, the rest of the episode blew me away. That was some ultimate episode stuff right there, and it's only episode 8. I can't wait for next week.
Yeah.
Well, Flacco, just in case you listen to this before you watch it, I don't know how that could possibly happen, but there we are. Keep in mind that they did basically have this huge budget busting battle in episode 8. There's a part of me that wonders if they did it now because everyone's expecting them to do something like that in episode 9 now, and they kind of said, haha, we did it in episode early.
Yes. That's kind of what I've been suspecting as well. Yeah, they're just
however, I will point out there is that whole fighting pit thing coming up.
Mm-hmm.
That might be fairly well timed to happen in episode 9.
Yeah.
Some stuff might happen there.
Mm-hmm.
No foreshadowing whatsoever, right? It's just a possibility, just throwing it out there. Anyway.
Yeah. Wait, which I guess means that the Spartacus comparisons will be flying left and right next week.
Oh, I would imagine so. So yes, this episode came in at a 9.5. That's really, really amazing. And we haven't had an episode of Game of Thrones to come in at a 9.5 since Joffrey choked to death.
Mm-hmm.
Just saying.
Yeah.
All right, moving on then to the rest of the content, where there's not a whole lot of the rest of the content, but
such
there we
as
are.
It is, yes.
Yes. We're going to start off with an episode that came in at an 8.5, so actually doing quite well for itself, and that is Wayward Pines, Season 1, Episode 3, Our Town, Our Law. New evidence is uncovered by Ethan, who, while still in shock that Kate participated in Beverly's reckoning in the town square, has another run-in with Sheriff Pope and is given a new house by a real estate agent. Okay. There, elsewhere, Teresa and Ben head to Idaho.
Yes.
And yeah.
And get ensnared.
And as I said, so much for concerns the story isn't moving fast enough. Gary, you gave this one a 9.5.
Oh, yeah. Gosh. I was really from this one. What for what this show is, I don't – short of revealing all the secrets, this was a pretty action-packed episode. Having his wife and kid actually enter this city, world, town, took me by surprise. I didn't expect to see that happening. I was figured we were going to deal with some sort of parallel outside world, inside world story. Then we have this whole time dilation thing that I still can't wrap my head around. He finds their car slightly wrecked with all that dust on it, yet at the same time it was the sheriff that cut the brake line to probably cause the accident that happened. Then the sheriff gets killed on top of it, which quite frankly I'm glad I never cared for Terrence Howard that much anyway, but that still shocked me. And then as they're trying to get out, they hear some growling or something like that, and then they all flip out. I said, you just killed the guy. What? How about you're in a car, and you hear some growling and you're flipping out? I don't
Dude, it could have been velociraptors. I'd be freaking out too. I don't know what that was supposed to be, but
all the time differences that we're seeing, we see, Kate is saying she's been there for like over 13 years when to him, it's been, has only been a few weeks. And, I can't quite piece it together. I did love the scene when the sheriff and the nurse are sort of on the phone, and the nurse grabs the phone and says to the sheriff, that's going to be enough. And then he realizes, he's like, I don't need to talk to you. You guys aren't really in charge. And even they were like, oh, crap. He's on to, sort of onto us a little bit. And so, that was an incredible scene for me because it sort of really sort of shifted the whole power back to him again, at least in my opinion. So, you had a lot of stuff going on, and it really sort of kept me on my toes the whole time. I really felt like I got my hours worth, or 48 minutes or 50 minutes of viewing out of the time that I watched. It was really good. I really couldn't see where they fell short. The son thinking that the father's cheating because he was talking to Kate. There was a lot of stuff in this episode.
Yeah, I'm just impressed that they managed to – that the show continues to kind of live up to its reputation, actually. I think maybe it's a little unfair, but I keep waiting for something to happen to say, oh, yeah, you know, there we go. There's that moment of going off the rails that we all expect to happen with M. Night Shyamalan. But I'm not seeing it. It's actually, like, the reviews continue to be really good. The story is moving along very nicely. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, and certainly it's I was not expecting, given some of the names that they got, that it was going to become almost like 10 Little Indians in terms of okay, who's going to get killed off this week? So, you know,
gruesomely, no less.
Yes,
so.
Yeah, you know, it's like no, you know, there's not going to be a cast left if they keep up at this rate. But,
well, they only have to have them around for 7 more episodes.
Well,
so.
Yes, exactly.
When you don't have to worry about keeping characters around for the next season, I guess that's what you can do. Evan, if you don't mind, next one.
Certainly. This would be Orphan Black, Season 3, Episode 7, Community of Dreadful Fear and Hate. Allison tries to get a storefront in order to take her and Donnie's business to the next level. Cosima faces familiar health issues and asks Allison for a favor.
Yes, and this one came in at an average of 8.25. I don't have too much to say about this because while I love Shay... Mm-hmm. Boy, do I love Shay.
Yes.
Allison's subplots have always been the weakest part of the show for me. And a whole episode kind of devoted to her? Yeah, it was still good. I gave it an 8, but it wasn't like over the top for me, mm-hmm. even with lots of Shay. Very, very unclad.
Yes.
Cassandra Solo showing parts of her, sides of her that we haven't seen on Lost Girl.
Down, John, down.
And yeah, I mean, I was obviously a little more positive. I mean, for me, the big thing was just having a episode that was so centered just on our regular clone club. And it almost made me wonder. I mean, in terms of sort of the definitive nature of Paul's sacrifice, how much the caster subplot. I mean, presumably, you know, I mean, Ari Melon is a major part of the show, but whether they are taking a little bit of a step back from that. I mean, I assume the casters are still going to be around, but I'm not sure if the that whole sort of military side of things hasn't been kind of shut down by what happened we've got the doctor. Presumably, the doctor is out of there. Paul's out of there. So this may mean a bit of a shift in focus and one that I would rather welcome.
Yeah, with only 3 episodes left, we'll see what happens. But we do know that the show is renewed for season 4, so there we are.
Yeah.
I'm still waiting for the inevitable announcement of the spinoff, Helena and Her Scorpion. I would watch that show, hands down.
No. She's eaten the scorpion. It's already over.
So you think. Plot twist.
Yes.
Bitten, Season 2, Episode 8, Dark Arts. Having possessed Clay's body, Alistair returns to Stonehaven to lay the groundwork for his plan to abduct Savannah. At the same time, Clay finds himself trapped in his unconscious, fighting to gain control of himself before he's destroyed. And this one came in at an 8. Bitten, like I said, with only 10 episodes versus 13, that kind of narrative focus seems to really be working for it. That and the fact that it doesn't kind of stray or hold back on the violence at all, which is good. Next we have Turn, Season 2, Episode 9, The Prodigal. Abe returns from prison with critical intel. Tensions rise between Hewlett and Simcoe. Arnold rescues Peggy from a rebel mob. And probably the best thing to come out of that recap is now we remember it's Hewlett. That's
yes,
his name.
Yes.
The dude that kind of looks like the guy who played Reed on Enterprise, but it's not. Anyway, this one came in at an 8 from both of us, Edmund. And anytime you get Simcoe and Hewlett in against each other in this show, it's like the tension rises dramatically. And that final act was something.
Yes. Yeah, it was. Yeah. No, I've been rather impressed actually at the way they've pulled off this retooling. I mean, with the calling it Washington Spies, putting more focus on Washington, and obviously starting up the Benedict Arnold plot line. But the fact that in the end, as they're heading into their finale, they actually have managed to bring it back to Satawkit, but in a way that feels natural, and with this really good conflict that they built up between these two characters who've been around from the beginning. But it just feels like the character development is they are just miles from where they were when they first got introduced, and where this is a conflict that you don't necessarily sympathize with either of them for various reasons, but it's been really really well laid out, and just feels very I'm very into seeing how they actually resolve this.
Yeah, with one episode left for the season, I'm kind of a little bit worried because I see the potential for them to set up a few things for another season, but I don't know that the ratings are good enough to ensure it.
Right.
Yes. So I was like, how are you going to do all this in one episode? I don't see how you can pull it off, but we'll see. But Turn is one of those shows where I enjoy it just so much that I hope it does come back.
Mm-hmm.
Come on, I need my Colonial stuff on TV. Anyway.
Definitely.
Finally, we kind of wrapping up this week's discussion with iZombie Season 1, Episode 12, Dead Rat, Live Rat, Brown Rat, White Rat.
And no, it's not Dr. Seuss inspired.
No, Liv is taken back to high school when she investigates a teen's death following a late-night joyride that ended in disaster and a cover-up. Later, one of the victim's friends dies, which raises some serious questions about the case. Meanwhile, Major thinks Blaine's Deli is not all it seems to be.
Yes.
And this episode came in at an 8. And it's the penultimate episode of the season, so lots of things getting set up for resolution in the finale. But Liv as a cheerleader, creepy yet kind of peppy.
Yes. Surprisingly energetic.
Yes.
Yeah, and
so much fun. So
yeah,
much fun.
Yeah, anyway. Yeah, no, and I thought they did a decent job of doing a I Know What You Did Last Summer parody mixed in there with certainly all of the setup and Major and her brother and everybody being put into a massive peril.
Yes,
but the one thing that I did find a little jarring was having Bex Taylor Klaus guest starring in basically the exact same costume that she wears in Arrow. And so
don't you understand? This is Sin undercover trying to escape her old life. It's the same character from Arrow. This is setting up a crossover.
Mm-hmm.
Come on, wouldn't that be right now? I guess not. Okay, fine.
Yeah, no, but we have people being resurrected
by the League of Assassins.
Right.
It could work. All right. But no, I completely agree with you. And just like I had the exact same problem when she was on Arrow, she looks so much like the actress that plays Trouble on Grimm that I can't get in my head that they're not the same person. So it drives me crazy. Anyway. Great show. I love where they've gone so far this season. It's well deserving the above average at this point.
Yes.
I'm glad that it got renewed. It took a few episodes to really find its footing, but now I feel like it's found its groove, and probably having its second half of the season when there's not a whole lot else on is helping it as well.
Yeah, definitely.
Because from what I understand, the ratings are holding pretty well. So
yeah, the CW is continuing its run. I mean, not everything they produce is a winner. The Messengers, but certainly, I mean, this has been quite its last 2 or 3 years now, where pretty much every year they've got a few series that they introduce that really take hold.
Yeah, and this one. It's good to see that there is a Rob Thomas show that on this network that's working out, because, it could have died on the vine as much as Veronica Mars seemed to. But for right now, at least it's picking up. And I have to say that, Jesse, the cosplayer that Bronstum and I both independently know somehow, does a really good Liv cosplay, like almost perfect, because their facial features are almost the same and it's like uncanny.
Wow.
But yes, that adds a little bit of fun to the whole thing, is that there are people, they're cosplaying Liv.
Yes.
They're cosplaying iZombie. But there we are. That's it. That's our episodic discussion for the week. Gary, any last thoughts for the week in general?
I might have to start producing my own show just so I have something to review next week at this rate. Well, no, it's just, you know, this is a pause, but it's a small pause. It's no longer the 2.5 month break that we used to see at this time. You know, we do have some new shows starting up, like JMS's Sense8 should have been released by the time we recorded this. So that's another Netflix show we'll be watching soon. So, no, there's new material coming out. We've got some of the other summer shows starting to come back. So, no, I'm looking forward to it.
Hmm. Yeah, definitely. I mean, the things are going to pick up again in the next couple weeks, to say the least. Not to the April-May levels by any means, but it is going to be in the swing of the summer season. And don't worry, Gary, there'll be stuff to watch. We went down a whole list last week.
I know, but so many – the important one left. Sorry. That's okay. We'll find something new. Although I heard Continuum was pushed back, sadly. So.
A little bit. Edmund, any last thoughts for this week?
No, but or I shouldn't say no. I said just one small one is that one of the shows that's returning, The Last Ship, of course. You know, yes, was that huge rating? I think somewhat unexpectedly, ratings hit for TNT last year, and apparently it's going to pick up right where it left off, because I have friends who did not watch it last summer, but since they've been running the repeats leading up to the premiere, they've actually started noticing it. So I suspect it may do just as well this summer.
One can only hope that the quality remains, because that was one of our real shocking revelations last summer.
Oh, yeah.
Was that show, that the one that we made fun of right up until it was on the air, and then we went, this isn't half bad.
Mm-hmm.
This is pretty good, actually. And yeah, we don't do that too often. But yeah, that's it. As far as I'm concerned, you know, interesting week. But next time we will continue to do our rundown of the last seasons, the last 12 months, and what was slowly rising up the ranks, and also see what kind of news we have coming our way. But I'm sure Bronstein will be trying to come back, because I think he wants to take a bite out of a show that has returned.
Yes, he does, and so do I.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google Plus, under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as fair use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the Critical Myth.